Anger on the streets of Caracas. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today on the show, large protests in the Venezuelan capital. They're calling on President Nicolas Maduro to step down. Meanwhile, Cubans are celebrating the first direct commercial flight from the U.S. in more than five decades and wondering what comes next.
Los 100 vuelos al día. The 100 flights that are going to start coming, you know. And there's a lot of questions. Are we ready and will we be able to cope? And will our country change?
Plus, meet livestock farmer Jim Leach. He really knows his customers.
Basically, the North Africa Muslims, they like female goats, bigger the better. The Nepali people, they like the castrated male goats. They won't eat a female against their religion.
Those stories, plus ditch that wire brush you use to clean your barbecue, today on The World. We're going to kick things off today in Venezuela, the Bolivar Republic, as it's known. Life there these days is hard. I mean, very hard. For months, people in Venezuela haven't been able to find the basics, whether it's food or toilet paper or medicine. There are long lines for pretty much everything. And crime is rampant, according to many reports. So a lot of Venezuelans have reached the breaking point. Today they came out to the center of the capital, Caracas, to protest. They're pushing for a new referendum to oust President Nicolas Maduro from power. Reporter Mariana Zuniga was at the protest.
Caracas woke up with a terrible weather, Marco, and you wouldn't expect so many people with that kind of weather, but people were coming in crowds to the Francisco de Miranda Avenue, where I was located a few hours ago in eastern Caracas, and you could see how from the slums of Petare, which is the biggest slum in the capital, were coming in crowds to join this manifestation. You could see how people had a cheerful attitude. They were chanting, they were dancing, they were actually having a good time despite all the problems that Venezuela is living right now. But they all have the same preoccupation in mind. They wanted food and they wanted medicines and they wanted now. That's what they were chanting and asking to the government.
So as far as what these Venezuelans want, food and medicine seems pretty basic, but how do they want the government to help them out?
So as a woman told me today, she knows that the situation is not going to be fixed in one day. She knows that probably the government will be gone and the economic situation in Venezuela is not going to improve immediately. But they said that if they manage to oust President Maduro this year with the recall referendum, at least they will have a hope that things will start changing for them.
You know, I saw this tweet the other day from a correspondent in Caracas that said, I used to occasionally see people picking through the trash in Caracas as night fell. Now it's every day starting around noon. So, Mariana, what's daily life for you like in Caracas? Are you able to find basic necessities?
Well, for me, it has become more difficult, especially because some people recur to the black market to buy the things that they need. But with this kind of inflation, 700% predicted for the lab for the end of the year, it's very difficult to keep buying those things to the bachaqueros, the name that these resellers were gave here in Venezuela. So we have to also join the lines very early, and it has become more difficult, and it has become more like a struggle for many families, and my family is included in this, of course.
Yeah, what's the longest line you've had to wait in so far, and what were you waiting for?
I was waiting to buy rice, and to be honest, I didn't wait that much compared to other people. It was more or less like an hour and a half.
Yeah, a lot of people I know would find that really egregious if they had to wait 90 minutes for rice, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Mariana, what is your sense of how this could all play out? Is the Venezuelan government going to budge?
To be honest, Marco, I don't know. It's very unpredictable, the whole situation in the country. I feel that people want a change, and you can feel it in the streets. Also, you can feel how this protest is very different from the ones that we had in 2014, because those protests were led by students mainly. And now you see a melting pot of backgrounds, a melting pot of social classes, and they all gathering to ask for the same thing. But at the same time, the government controls many things, like the electoral authorities, and they are the ones who are going to decide when or if we are going to have the recall referendum this year or not.
Right. Reporter Mariana Zúñiga in Caracas, Venezuela. Thank you very much for your time today, Mariana.
You're welcome.
Venezuela's political and economic turmoil is also affecting Cuba. The Castro brothers and Hugo Chavez were close, and Cuba still depends heavily on Venezuela for economic help. At the same time, Cuba's relations with the U.S. are warming. Witness yesterday, for the first time in 50 years, a direct commercial flight flew from the U.S. to Cuba. The plane was saluted by water cannons during both takeoff and landing. But are Cubans celebrating? Reporter Deepa Fernandez used to live in Cuba, and she just returned from a visit there this summer. What does this all mean for Cubans, Deepa?
Well, I think Cubans are excited. Obviously, there's also some trepidation. But, Marco, I have to tell you that, you know, everyone I met, when they said to me, oh, where are you from? And I would say, I live in Los Angeles. The first thing people would say, they'd look at you, their eyes would open up wide, and they'd say, los 100 vuelos al día, the 100 flights that are going to start coming, you know. And there's a lot of questions. Are we ready, and will we be able to cope, and will our country change?
Well, I remember back in March, there was Easter, Obama visited, and the Rolling Stones were all in Havana in the same week, and the city essentially collapsed. Can they actually handle this influx of tourists and visitors?
You know, even in Havana, there's a dire shortage of hotel rooms. There is a state plan, you know, and I think it's something like 60,000 hotel rooms will be built over the next year. But, you know, in some ways, there is also this kind of Airbnb model that's existed for years and years. It's called Casas Particulares, and people rent out rooms in their homes. So I think if, you know, if people are thinking about going, they should understand it's a different kind of tourism in going to Cuba.
What about, like, taxi drivers?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, you know, Marco. A taxi driver really can just be a person with a car. You know, classic photos that we've all seen of the old American Chevys, the old American cars. People are doing those up. They're painting them. They're tinkering away a little bit every day to get them ready for when those 100 vuelos start coming, because they can make money by taking people around. And I think the flip side to that is that when I was just there at the end of the summer, there was a lot of people saying, because of the Venezuelan crisis that you mentioned leading into this, that maybe petrol prices, gasoline prices are going up, and people won't be able to afford this 10 pesos, so the price will go up. And on my second to last day in Havana, the price like doubled
Wow.
overnight.
So to adjust to this whole new tourist economy, seems like there will also have to be some infrastructural changes. But can Cuba afford the price tag?
And that's the big question. And I think especially with Venezuela and, you know, the tens of thousands of barrels of oil that may not be coming to Cuba anymore, this is going to lead to another economic crisis. And the Cuban government has already warned the people. They're saying, be prepared. There have already been some small electricity rolling cuts, blackouts happening. You know, state workers are being sent home early. And the price tag of replacing those Venezuelan barrels of oil, at this point, the best hope for that is the tourist economy.
So, Deepa, you lived in Havana 2 decades ago, but you were back this past summer. What really stood out for you after that time?
Well, Marco, you know, some things have changed and some things just haven't. The Cuban people are still really warm and embracing, and they want to know you and talk to you. But, you know, there was a little underlying tension that I detected, that even, you know, I was there in the last economic crisis, the special period it was called, and times were really hard. Think like 12, 14, 16 hours without electricity. You know, everything in your fridge is going to go off. It's stiflingly hot, and, you know, you might have to sleep outside just to get some air. You know, during those times, I didn't feel the kind of clenched tension that people were holding. You know, I even saw a couple of scuffles break out as people were like waiting in line and they thought somebody pushed in. And when I lived in Cuba 2 decades ago, I didn't really witness this. That was stuff people would just like let wash off them. You know, it's like, okay, they pushed in, that's okay. But, you know, many people were saying there is tension. People are very scared that they're going to go back into that deep economic crisis mode.
Reporter Deepa Fernandez, thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
Hawaii, the place to be for the next week and a half if you're an environmental policymaker. Officials and scientists from more than 170 nations are meeting for a conference called Planet at the Crossroads. They've got plenty of bleak headlines out there to consider about the state of the planet's environment, but there are some bright spots, especially when it comes to protecting the oceans. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
When most Americans were asleep last night, President Obama was speaking to a small group of domestic and foreign scientists and dignitaries in Hawaii.
Well, welcome to Hawaii. It's aloha.
The president talked about how rising temperatures and sea levels are threatening many Pacific Island nations. He spoke about the need to develop more clean energy and waste less energy overall. He also talked about conservation. Using the power given to presidents under the 1906 National Antiquities Act, Obama has now protected more than twice as much land and water as any president before him. His latest national monument is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in waters near the Hawaiian Islands. Obama's quadrupling an area protected by President George W. Bush 10 years ago. It's called Papahanu Mokua Kea.
This is an area twice the size of Texas that's going to be protected and allows us to save and study the fragile ecosystem threatened by climate change.
The White House says the expanded marine sanctuary will protect swaths of black coral, as well as 7,000 marine species, including whales, sea turtles, and big-eye tuna, commonly called ahi. Jeff Waters with the group Ocean Conservancy says the new marine sanctuary is a huge deal, not just for what it accomplishes, but for the signal it sends to the rest of the world.
Because the United States has said, you know, we've not just spoken with words, we've spoken with action. And that elevates the conversation to a whole new level of seriousness that is crucial and that really makes me excited and hopeful for the future.
Environmentalists are also excited because there seems to be a bit of a spirited competition going on. Which nation can protect the largest swaths of ocean? Matt Rand, who directs the Global Ocean Legacy Project with the Pew Charitable Trusts, says expanding Papahanu Mokua Kea keeps the momentum going in a big way.
Before President Obama expanded it, it had fallen to the 10th largest marine reserve, which is actually great news. That means 10 other countries and 10 other marine reserves went and one-upped the original Papahanu Mokua Kea.
Now, once again, it's the largest marine sanctuary in the world.
Our hope is that President Obama's bold action now starts another race to protect the ocean.
But that's sure to be met with stiff resistance from the fishing industry. Paul Dalzell is a senior scientist with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council in Hawaii. He says they've set up their own protections to maintain healthy fish populations with things like catch limits. He says the new marine sanctuary is arbitrary and ignores the latest science.
These environmentalists are going to try and protect something, whether that protection is warranted or not. They're professional advocates, and it's their job to find something to protect.
Environmentalists argue that marine sanctuaries can actually help the fishing industry. Setting up marine protections strengthens ecosystems. This, in turn, promotes more productive fisheries outside of protected areas. Dalzell sees things another way. He says limiting the areas where they traditionally fish will allow foreign fishermen to take away some of their market share.
You know, how would you like to be told we're going to take away 10% of your income, but you're free to go and find other work that'll make that up?
Jeff Waters with Ocean Conservancy understands those concerns.
Yeah, of course, they would like as much, you know, freedom as possible as they go about doing their jobs. But the fishing industry isn't the only voice out there that needs to be listened to, and they're not the only consideration when it comes to these global environmental issues. There's a much, much bigger picture at play here.
Matt Rand with the Pew Charitable Trusts adds, even with all the new marine sanctuaries, the scales still tip heavily in favor of fishing interests.
We're still at a little less than 3% of the ocean fully protected, and scientists are calling for up to 30% of the ocean to be protected. So there's quite a ways to go.
That said, just 10 years ago, almost none of the world's oceans were fully protected. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Hey, Growmasters, listen up. It might be time to rethink that wire brush. That's just ahead, so stick around. You're with The World. We're headed to upstate New York for this next story about a family farm. Now, there's nothing easy about keeping a small farm going these days, but Leach Farms in Martville, New York, has figured out a way to turn a profit. Immigrants in the area wanted to buy live goats and other animals that they can slaughter according to their own traditions. So farm owner Jim Leach decided to tap into that market. Reporter Danielle Price visited some satisfied Nepali customers.
Namaste. Namaste, bye.
On a hot August evening, Kinamaya Kadaria swishes in a green flower print sari as she puts the finishing touches on dinner. The rice is warming in the rice cooker. The fermented greens were prepared days ago. She stirs a steaming pot a few more times as red and gold bangles slide down her arm.
I'm cooking meat.
Duck, to be exact. Kinamaya cooks duck or goat about every other week, but in the refugee camp where she used to live in eastern Nepal, eating meat was an expensive luxury.
In Nepal, we ate it once a month or once every 2 months.
The Kadaria family raised their own goats, ducks, and chickens, which they would slaughter and butcher at home. But when they moved to Rochester, New York 5 years ago, the family had to adjust to new eating habits, like grocery stores and packaged foods.
We don't like to eat like the market meat because it is not fresh.
That's Netra Kadaria, Kinamaya's 35-year-old son.
Some of my relatives, they already came here in the U.S., and they find the place where we get the fresh meat.
That place is Leech Farms, about 60 miles away in Martville, New York.
So how long are you going to be before you're here?
Here is the biggest live goat business in New York State.
Okay, brother. Thank you.
Owner Jim Leech, now 36, says he's been in the meat business since before he could drive, hawking cuts to local butcher shops as a teenager on his family's farm. Selling live animals cuts out the middleman and allows farmers to keep more of what can be a thin profit margin. But there are only so many New Yorkers, even upstate, who want to undertake the messy business of butchering their own dinners. One big exception is immigrants, many with an appetite for goat. In 2000, Leech was approached by a church working with Burmese refugees in nearby Syracuse, New York. They wanted to do the butchering themselves. He's been selling live animals ever since.
I'm supplying them. I feed a lot of families. You know, I'm supplying them with a food source that they were accustomed to at home. They want to first pick out their own animal. Most everybody was farmers themselves. But being taken out of their country and first putting into Syracuse or Rochester or, you know, into a city for a situation, they still want that farm experience.
There are practical matters at hand, too. Different groups want animals processed in particular ways, like halal for many Muslim immigrants, or the ritual sacrifice of goats Nepali families typically perform for the upcoming Hindu festival of Dussehra. Leech says this is now his busiest time of the year. According to USDA regulations for direct market operations like his, Leech can sell live animals but can't slaughter them. He is allowed to provide space on the farm for customers to do their own slaughtering and butchering. Now, he gets to keep more of the profits, and his diverse customers get exactly what they want.
Each group is a little bit different, what they want to consume. It's all what they were raised eating. Basically, the North Africa Muslims, they like female goats, as far as bigger the better. The Nepali people, they like the castrated male goats. They won't eat a female against their religion.
The farm sells a lot more than just goats, though.
Ducks, rabbits, as far as roosters, young roosters and old. Pigeons, quail, you know, there's white pigeons, there's black pigeons, rabbits, you know, you name it, it's pretty much here. So.
And as you heard there, pigs.
Muslims do not want to have any pork products or pigs near their work area or their, as far as goats or lambs. So the pigs are housed in, as far as the other end of the barn.
This level of customer service makes a big difference to newcomers like Netra Kadaria.
When I went to the first time, I didn't believe that he was like the same system like our country.
But Leech says he's not doing this as charity. There's money to be made in goats. Leech estimates he sells around 3,000 live goats a year at $4 a pound. Altogether, he's pulling in $1 million in sales annually. He also relies on the closeness of tight-knit immigrant communities for his business to spread by word of mouth. So far, it's working.
They want to keep that tradition alive, you know, as far as, you know, processing their own meat the way they have for centuries, as far as back in their own homeland. But here, as far as, you know, they're able to see that, but I've seen over the years that children, you know, once they, if they've been here 6, 8 years, 10 years, they sometimes get Americanized. They don't want to come out to the farm and get dirty anymore.
Leech knows that his model can't depend on second-generation immigrants wanting to continue their parents' and grandparents' traditions. But he also expects that the influx of immigrants, and especially refugees, is unlikely to die down anytime soon. For The World, I'm Danielle Price.
Still on the subject of meat, with Labor Day weekend coming up, we've got some news you can use when you barbecue. It comes to us from Canada, and I'm really glad to hear this because earlier this summer, it occurred to me while I was cleaning my barbecue with one of those metal bristle brushes, and I noticed some of those bristles stayed behind on the grill. That won't taste good, I thought, so I picked them off. Well, not only won't it taste good, swallowing those bristles can damage your throat. And Canadian doctors have sent out the alert, throw away your metal grill brushes. Let's check in with Rob Rainford. He's a Canadian barbecue chef and author of Born to Grill. He's in Toronto. So what's your reaction to this warning from these doctors in Canada, Rob?
Well, you know what? It was alarming to hear. I've seen bristles being left behind before, but again, I would always attribute that to an older brush that should be changed out pretty much season after season. I'd been doing mine sort of instinctually, but I think everybody across the board that can listen to the airways and my voice, change your brush every season.
I understand that hospitals near Halifax in Nova Scotia are seeing one or two cases of this each week. And if the bristles get deeper into the body, it can require very fine surgery, they say. It sounds pretty darn serious. Are barbecue chefs talking about this?
I can tell you this. You know, this is a conversation we're going to have. And I would make sure that, you know, anybody that's doing this for a living, they would obviously know, you know, change out your brush, obviously. But yeah, you have to understand, these guys, you know, if you have something that stayed with you for a couple of years, you would use it all the time, right?
Yeah.
Until you see something or until you're notified that this has happened, you would never know. So my issue is, you know, again, to eliminate that, if you see that there's wear and tear on your brush, just change it.
Right. So check out the brush. What about options for cleaning the grill?
What I like to do is a deep clean on my barbecue pretty much every year. So that means, you know, you can do the easy bake oven kind of approach where you spray it, you bake it for a long period of time, and then you wipe it down. So that's one way to clean your grill. At the end of each shift, okay, what I like to do is I turn the barbecue on high. Even if you're doing charcoal, whatever, just let it burn. Close the lid, and then literally all that debris that's near the top of your barbecue, you could brush that. You can knock it off. I'm in Toronto, so which just means, you know, we have a shorter growing season, but I grill all year round.
So you were born in Jamaica. You now grill in Toronto. What's your personal style? Is it kind of jerk sauce with maple syrup?
You know what? Maybe you just designed a new menu item for me. I hadn't thought about bridging the two gaps. But, you know, for me, I cook based on taste. I mean, I grew up Jamaican, obviously, and I'm still Jamaican. But from a culinary standpoint, I learned classical French to start. So I use those approaches when I'm thinking about any kind of cooking. So my styles are just marrying, you know, blending flavors. I love big, bold flavors. I like mild flavors. But, you know, I like playing with flavors.
Rob Rainford, he was Born to Grill. That's also the name of his book. Rob, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, a university professor who took more than just a sabbatical. He now commands a rebel army.
He lives a very sort of monastic existence in an ordinary bungalow with a bunch of fellow commanders. You know, a guy who was a taxi driver, a guy who was an engineer in Arlington, Virginia.
That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. So, dos Trump, two Donald Trumps. That's what Mexicans saw yesterday, two sides of the Republican candidate. The first was a calm statesman speaking at a news conference alongside Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto.
We are united by our support for democracy, a great love for our people, and the contributions of millions of Mexican-Americans to the United States.
At the news conference, Trump said that building a border wall was discussed, but not who was going to pay for it. Then, hours later, Trump was in Arizona for a rally. The tone and the message, very different.
We will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall.
Trump added that Mexico will pay for the wall, 100% of it, he says. President Peña Nieto is adamant that Mexico won't. Quite the day. And Mexico City resident Gabby Perez watched it all. She's Mexican, who knows life north of the border also pretty well. Gabby, what did you make of the press conference?
Depressing. I don't have a better word.
And then hours later, another Donald Trump in Arizona at a rally. What kind of things did you hear in Mexico City from your friends, acquaintances about that difference and about what he said when he got to Arizona?
I think Mexico's been really obsessed with Donald Trump because we know who he is. We've heard him say what he has to say. I think for us, we were more disappointed in the president for going down this path.
Peña Nieto.
Yes. I don't think, again, Trump you know, you don't expect anything from him. You know, he's made it clear where he stands. I think what was very disappointing made us incredibly angry, and I think the hardest part is made you terribly sad, was to see the president. I think that was, at least all the comments I heard, nobody was really more offended by Trump. I mean, how much more can you get? I think it was just a great deal of sadness and shame for our president for being part of this whole circus.
So as a Mexican, elaborate on what it's like to watch all this, especially from Mexico City.
Well, you feel helpless. I have family in the U.S., so it obviously worries me. But it really just makes you feel very helpless, very disillusioned in your leadership, in the leadership of our country.
You're referring to Mexico.
Yes. Yeah. Because we can't really do much about Trump. That's an American problem that we'll all have to deal with, but it's not like I can vote or anything. What we can do is hopefully have a strong leadership here who is very clear about why we would find that offensive and how that isn't acceptable. And I don't think we've had that.
Do you think President Peña Nieto understands that and maybe even regrets his decision?
Oh, I'm sure they regret it from the day one. But I think yesterday I was in a meeting with some old-time Mexican government officials, you know, retired or stuff like that. They support, they are institutional, you know, the president is a president. And just to see how sad they were was very disheartening. So I think for Mexicans, most of us, we're not angry. I mean, we're always angry at Trump. That's just the state of life. But I think it was just so disheartening to see the president do that. It just makes you feel alone, you know?
Mm. The fact that Trump gave a nod, a rare nod, to Mexicans and their contributions when they emigrate legally to the U.S., did that provide any consolation?
None. No, I don't think so. Again, I don't think that was what any Mexican was expecting. I think the only thing, and I'm just thinking about what I saw posted on my friends' Facebooks and Twitters and what I've talked to, the only acceptable thing was an apology. And anything less than that was not going to be of interest to us.
Gabby, thanks very much for your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Gabby Perez speaking with us from her home of Mexico City. Last night, Trump took aim at one particular group in his speech in Arizona, criminal aliens. Trump batted around some astonishing figures, so we had the world's Matthew Bell do a bit of fact-checking.
Trump says it's hard to believe, but people don't even talk about the issue of criminal aliens. But he sure does.
Zero tolerance for criminal aliens. Zero. Zero.
On day one, during his first hour in office, Trump vows these people will be gone. And there are a lot of them.
There are at least 2 million, 2 million, think of it, criminal aliens now inside of our country. 2 million people, criminal aliens.
But is that figure accurate? Michelle Mittelstadt at the Migration Policy Institute says not exactly.
We estimated that there are 820,000 unauthorized immigrants in the United States who have ever been convicted of a crime.
That research looked at the estimated 11 million people living in the U.S. without legal authorization, a.k.a. undocumented immigrants, and it found that those who've been convicted of crimes added up to 820,000. So where did Trump get the 2 million? It might come from the Center for Immigration Studies. That's a Washington-based organization that favors lowering the numbers of immigrants entering the U.S. And when it counts non-citizens who've been convicted of crimes, it also includes green card holders. But these are legal residents, and there are about 13 million of them, hence Trump's higher number overall. And here's something else to think about. Trump accuses the Obama administration of allowing criminal aliens to return to communities in the U.S. and then not deporting them. Mittelstadt says that's not exactly right either.
By prioritizing for removal, criminal aliens, gang members, recent entrants, which were three of the categories that Mr. Trump mentioned last night, those actually are already groups of people who have been identified for removal. So in some ways, it's a continuation of the policy that is already in place.
Mittelstadt says U.S. policy has focused on deporting criminal aliens going back a decade, and that's continued during President Obama's time in office. The peak was 2013. According to the Department of Homeland Security, 435,000 people were deported that year. Almost 200,000 of them were criminals. Over the past couple of years, the total number of deportations appears to have fallen. One reason for this, though, is that the Obama administration has narrowed its focus. Unauthorized immigrants who've committed crimes are now a top priority for deportation, instead of the much larger number of people here in the U.S. illegally. And here's one final comparison that might be useful in all of this. Even if Trump is exactly right, and there really are 2 million criminals among the population of 11 million illegal immigrants in America, how does that compare with the rest of the country? If you look at estimates for adult Americans who've been arrested or detained, but not necessarily convicted of a crime, it's almost 1 out of 3 adults. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Donald Trump's rhetoric yesterday was confusing because of the contrast between what he said in Mexico and what he said in his speech, but it was certainly not uniformly anti-immigrant. At one point, he acknowledged the contributions immigrants make to the United States. We're going to talk about those contributions now with Rupa Shenoy, host of our podcast Otherhood, which is all about the experiences of immigrants in the U.S. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco.
So you're immersed in the topic of immigration every day. What strikes you about this notion of immigrants giving back?
It's corny, right? It's big and general and just really corny.
I came here to seek shelter. I'm now going to contribute to society.
Right. I worked really hard. I was really poor. But the thing is, it's true. If you've lived the life of an immigrant background, it's very, very true. And it's hard to convey. So that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to get really specific with one group to show people how it works.
What group did you choose?
They're called the Paul and Daisy Soros Fellows. They're about 550 people, and they're almost like a secret club of some of the most successful people in the country, created by Paul and Daisy Soros, hence the name. And if the last name sounds familiar, it's because of George Soros, probably, the billionaire philanthropist. Paul was his older brother, and his wife Daisy told me about how he defected from Russian-occupied Hungary and came to this country in 1948. He had no money and had to go to a community college instead of MIT or Stanford.
He always told me if somebody just would have kind of given him $10,000 at that time, his whole life would have been totally different.
And that always frustrated Paul Soros. So decades later, when he built shipping ports across the world and made a ton of money, he decided this is how he wants to use his money, for these fellowships that pay for graduate school for immigrants and kids of immigrants, including some that didn't come to this country legally. And now those fellows are incredibly influential and successful. And this is a fellow named Andre Cherney. He's the youngest person ever to serve as White House speechwriter.
Mm. So often we hear this idea that immigrants are coming here to take advantage of the system. And I think we need to be reminded that there is a powerful through line with the people showing up today at LAX. The idea of giving back is something that you hear from immigrants in every conversation. That story needs to be told and retold and retold again.
So, Rupa, he's writing words to communicate from the White House. How are some of these other fellows giving back?
So people who grow up in two different cultures, they kind of have to pick and choose and create who they are. So in their ways of giving back, they are very individual. For example, Jeannie Suk is a 2001 Soros Fellow who became the first Asian American woman tenured at Harvard University. She writes articles in places like The New Yorker about the law surrounding issues like transgender bathrooms and sexual assault on college campuses. And it makes her a lightning rod. People just say horrible things about her on the internet, and she keeps doing it.
Sometimes things should be said that maybe other people aren't willing to come out and say. I mean, they should be said in a reasonable manner that is supported by logic and evidence. That is my aim, to take on really difficult issues, to have the most difficult conversations. And maybe this is a hopeless task, but I still have hope in reason.
Rupa, is part of the giving back idea, recognizing in part how much you've been given yourself?
Yeah. So this is something I actually originally said to you, and it made me realize how I came upon this myself. So I had always gone to India with my mom every other year. And then finally, when I was in my 20s, I saw my dad there, and we met him in his village in South India. And it was like that moment where the Wizard of Oz becomes all color. Right. It's like, wow, this was all there, and I didn't even realize it. Like, he was charming and engaging, and it was something I'd never seen.
What a revelation.
So I had no idea that he had given all that up. And that's what they all do. I mean, they're completely different people in another culture. Everyone has their own story of that. So Jeannie Sook still thinks about how her life could have been very different if her parents hadn't taken the risk of fleeing North Korea.
I think very frequently about what my life would be if my parents had not been able to flee. I would not be here, of course. I would just have a completely, utterly different existence, and I would be a different person, really. I think about that so much. It's very difficult for me not to fixate sometimes on the contingency of life, even as I'm putting all my effort into making the most out of the things that I have.
Trying to live up to the opportunities they have.
Right. They're sort of haunted by gratitude. And I say haunted because this drive to make up for the fact that you got to be American while many other people didn't, you can't turn it on and off. So I talked to Pardis Sabedi. Her family's from Iran, and she's a 2001 Soros Fellow. She's one of the world's best geneticists, and she played a big role in stopping the West Africa Ebola outbreak in 2014. And on top of all of that, she's also the lead singer in a band.
Yeah, she was here. She's a badass geneticist for sure.
But a few months after she got back from Africa, she had this terrible accident. She was on an ATV and it flipped over. She broke almost every bone in her body. And it was a long, tough recovery. When I talked to her, she was still so tired and still trying to push herself through every day and trying to understand what happened and why. Because her dad had the same accident. Pretty much when she was a kid. And there were these eerie echoes for her. And she was trying to understand, you know, what does that mean that these things happen to us?
I'm not sure. You never know where these numbers come from. But like, basically, the amount of bones my dad shattered and the amount of bones I shattered in this accident, it's described as like there's an 8% chance of survival. The fact that you actually, you know, blew out like all of these bones and didn't happen to like sever, you know, the femoral artery and bleed out is very unusual. So we both were in that deeply, deeply unlucky cohort where we're so deeply unlucky, but also so deeply lucky. The luckiest of the unlucky.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
Yeah. But she refuses to feel sorry for herself. Despite everything, she still feels a duty to give back.
One of my students, I was just with them and they were really like thankful because I spent a long time kind of helping them navigate their lives. And I was like, I'll be honest with you, like, because I think my students are all smarter and better than me, and I was like, if all I ever achieve is helping you self-actualize and get what you need to do on this earth, then I'm done. Like, I'll just peace out. So in my mind, if I can actually get my students where they need to go, that's how I can affect the most change on this planet. To be honest, it's a little bit selfish. That's how I believe I will actually have a lasting impact.
So these are some pretty intense stories, Rupa, about the first and second generation immigrants giving back. What was your takeaway?
You know, here we are as a country debating the merits of immigration, but we can't escape the fact that the country is built on immigration. And some of the most successful Americans are immigrants who are focused on making America better. And if you look at the Soros Fellows, it's difficult to see what distinguishes them from the people coming today.
Rupa Shenoy of the Otherhood podcast, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can find that podcast at pri.org/otherhood or on iTunes. Check it out. Definitely worth your time. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. On the face of it, this next item might sound like a midlife crisis story. A man in his late 50s, good job, comfortable life. But in this case, he did not buy a convertible sports car or have an affair. Last summer, Berhanu Nega took an indefinite leave of absence from his tenured professorship at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, said goodbye to his family, and went off to the Horn of Africa to head up an Ethiopian rebel movement. Reporter Josh Hammer tracked him down, and this weekend you can read his profile of Berhanu Nega in the New York Times Magazine. This is one hell of a midlife crisis, Josh. Remind us first of the kind of life Nega left behind when he got on that plane for Africa last summer.
Yes, indeed. He was, he is an Ethiopian exile, so he has always had one foot in that world. But he had developed a very American lifestyle. He was a tenured professor at Bucknell University in rural Pennsylvania, had a very nice suburban house, rooted for the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Eagles, barbecues in the backyard, summers on the beach of Maryland, campaigning door-to-door for Barack Obama in 2008, sending his kids to good American schools. So a very American existence.
So today, where is he and what's his life like?
Today, he is living in the capital of Eritrea in the Horn of Africa, a city called Asmara, which is a very poor, very remote, isolated city in a very poor and isolated country, one of the most repressive dictatorships in the world. But they also happen to be a mortal enemy of Ethiopia and have offered Berhanu Nega and his rebel cohorts a refuge and a sanctuary and a base of operations for this war that they are leading against the Ethiopian regime.
So the aim of Ginbot 7 and of Nega, they want to overthrow the whole Ethiopian regime?
Well, Ethiopia is an ally of the United States. It's a strategic partner in the war against al-Shabaab, a radical Islamic movement in Somalia. However, behind that stability is really one of the most oppressive regimes in Africa, if not the world. There's a great amount of discontent. So Nega wants to get in there, get rid of this regime, and bring in real democracy.
Yeah, we saw the Ethiopian marathoner at the Olympics who came across the finish line with his arms up in an X, protesting what he feels is major authoritarianism in his native country. So how's he living? What's his life like in Asmara? It doesn't sound anything like what he had in Pennsylvania.
It's a pretty Spartan lifestyle. I mean, Asmara is a city where it's hard to get things. The power goes off a lot. There are water shortages, shortages of just about everything. It has the lowest internet penetration of any country on the planet, 1%. So getting a decent broadband connection is very, very difficult. He lives a very sort of monastic existence in an ordinary bungalow with a bunch of fellow commanders, all of whom are from the diaspora around the world. So you got, you know, a guy who was a taxi driver, a guy who was an engineer in Arlington, Virginia, a guy from the UK, somebody from Luxembourg. They all Ethiopians, and they all kind of come back through this house. And then, of course, he spends an awful lot of time down on, you know, a couple of hundred miles south along that very militarized, very mined border in these rebel base camps, kind of rallying the troops, dealing with politics, teaching political seminars, watching training, doing all the things that commanders do.
You've met him several times now, Josh, here in the States and over in the Horn of Africa. What kind of man is he?
He's a very approachable, very passionate, very likable guy. There do seem to be these two sides to him. On the one hand, he fit in extremely well, was highly popular on campus. I mean, his students loved him, and he was a very gregarious figure. Faculty kind of hosted a lot of faculty dinners, just fit in very well in that academic American lifestyle. On the other hand, I've seen him in a different incarnation, leading a rally for his rebel group, and he takes on a very different appearance. He becomes kind of transformed into this rebel leader, rallying the troops, celebrating the killings of police and soldiers. An operation had taken place about a month earlier, and he was drawing attention to the victory of the rebels down in this part of Ethiopia. So it's kind of jarring to see these two aspects of his life and his personality coexisting this way.
Yeah, violence sounds like a theme. And again, it sounds like there's another David versus Goliath fight as this little Ginbot 7 takes on the Ethiopian army. It sounds like an uphill battle for these rebels. Why did Nega make this decision? I mean, in midlife, we tend to think people reorder their values.
This is true. Well, he's always been for the last, you know, he was brutally imprisoned in Ethiopia after running for mayor and getting that snatched away from him. He was expelled from the country, but he's maintained one foot in that world for all this time and never really gave up on the idea of returning to Ethiopia. His best friend was actually the guy who was out in the field in Eritrea dealing with the troops. And when this friend was captured, put in prison and given a death sentence, suddenly the top job was open. And Nega just felt, well, you know, I have to do this. I have to do this. I feel an obligation to my country. Somebody has to step in and fill this role, and it can only be me. So it was kind of a major sacrifice, you know, and the family wasn't necessarily all in favor of it.
So, Josh, is he going to stick it out there in the Horn of Africa and continue this fight against Ethiopia?
You know, he says he is. He believes that they've got momentum. There's no question that more attention is being paid to the undemocratic, repressive side of Ethiopia. I think you certainly saw that with the Olympics. But I get the sense, and it may just because suddenly I'm focused on this place, but you get the sense that that government may be crumbling a little bit, whether it's 5 years down the line or 10 years down the line, or whether this is just a totally quixotic enterprise that is going to go nowhere. It's at this point really difficult to say.
Reporter Josh Hammer wrote the profile of Ethiopian rebel commander Berhanu Nega on leave from his teaching position at Bucknell University. You can read the profile in the New York Times Magazine this weekend. Josh, thanks so much for your time.
Great to be here.
The year is 1978, and smack in the middle of Ethiopia and Eritrea's first long conflict, 3 decades long in fact, the house band would gather at the swanky Gayan Hotel in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The Dalak band had a pretty soulful sound, and on one particular afternoon in 78, they were joined by Hailu Mergia. He was a band leader and keyboard player at the Addis Hilton, just down the road. These days, Hailu Mergia lives in Washington, D.C. and drives a taxi. But in 1978, with the house band at the Hilton, this restless creative artist was playing mellow dinner music. So he hooked up with the Dalak band to see what kind of instrumental jams they might produce. For 3 days during the Dalak band's usual afternoon rehearsals, they recorded what they played on tape. That cassette remained with Hailu Mergia over the years and has finally been released on CD and on vinyl. The circle, after nearly 40 years, is unbroken. Thanks for being with us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.